Good morning, Tucson, and welcome. We appreciate you being with us this morning, listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. It's in time for some engagement hours. And behind the glass, Matt Neely, as always, keeping me on time and on target.
Good morning, Ted.
5 days a week, The Morning Voice, five different hosts, five different approaches, five different topics, and always a little bit of politics mixed in, at least for most of us. Okay, at least on Tuesdays. And probably on Wednesdays.
At least.
A little bit on Mondays. Okay. And you get a little bit of all. Can't get away from the politics.
Hardly ever. Yeah.
What? You just can't get away from the politics. But I'll tell you, there was some interesting information in there. I'm glad I was listening to your news read-in.
Little alternate routes in Oro Valley.
Yeah. I didn't even know that. I'll have to stay away from Naranja now. Luckily, it's between La Cañada and First. I'm normally crossing that on the way down. But
all right.
But that I found that incredibly interesting, as well as, what do you think it takes to fail an English language proficiency test for a truck driver?
Yeah, I don't know. I'd like to see the cue cards for that test, you know, like the set of questions that they ask.
Well, sometimes you always wonder when there's government things out there how in depth it's going to be. But the ability to read signs obviously would be pretty critical. If you don't understand the road signs, the safety signs, that's problematic.
Yeah.
But I'd be curious to see it. It's kind of like the civics test. We've talked a lot about that. Now the majority of Americans can't pass the civics test that used to be standard requirements in the school and the education system.
Right.
Take the U.S. citizenship test, and it's not going to be a great impressive pass rate for the country on kind of things. And so,
You know, probably I'll be voicing an unpopular opinion, but going back to the 1970s when I was a young lad in grade school and junior high, I remember they talked about traffic signs and what different colors mean, what different shapes mean. And the whole upshot of that whole conversation was it's supposed to be sort of international.
Exactly.
Like it's supposed to be that anybody could understand it. Now, I understand that there are laws on the books that they have to have a certain English proficiency. And if it's a law that's on the books, it can fairly be enforced. But what I'm trying to say is that there was an intentionality to the way we did our road signs that they could be understood sort of universally without anyway.
You mean like green is go, green is good, right. Red is danger, right. Red is, you should think. Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right.
So
it's just, when I see and hear stuff like
phone call or two, but
honestly, Matt, when I see stuff like that, I kind of go, okay, I wonder what the questions are. I wonder how it's going about. And I'm not,
they're asking
I don't
about
think
the flight velocity of an African swallow. It's a Monty Python reference. It might be a little different.
What is your name?
What is your quest? Again, yeah. I'm reverting to my infantile Monty Python references.
No, but I have not heard some of those quotes in quite a while. So it's good to bring that back. So before we go on to another issue that's is impacting us here locally, got to ask, Houston-Arizona football game.
A mutual friend of ours and his wife actually went to the game. I think my takeaway from the last 2 weeks of Arizona football is they're good enough to play against good teams. They came back down two touchdowns on the road, so give them credit for that. A friend of mine who actually used to work here said they're good enough. They're good enough to tie, but you know they're just not good enough to win, right? Meaning they're way light years ahead of where they were last year.
Way ahead of what I expected,
right.
Actually, on coming into this year.
So they're a good team. They can play teams tough. They can play teams close. And now they just need to make that little jump to taking, you know, tying a game and then closing out the deal and winning it. So, you know, I'm trying to be the glasses half full guy here, but they are better than last year. And they've done two consecutive tough opponents where they came out just a little bit on the...
Yeah, I'll take it even to three quarters full on that,
sure.
That front, because I totally agree with you. The things that hurt us is tough time handling a running quarterback. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been really impressed with the defense. They're swarming. They're all over the place.
Yep.
Really tough time handling the quarterback. And it is, if you're there at the end, you got to win them. I think you got to get that kill. Don't take a chance. Let's put it to the throat. Take points when you can get them.
Right.
And because to lose the last two games – pretty good quality teams. I mean, especially BYU. BYU went up and beat Utah despite being an underdog in that game, being they were listed as an underdog even though they're undefeated. So nobody's respecting BYU, but they're putting together a pretty successful team, and they had a quarterback that could run the ball. Mm-hmm. And this kid from Houston, I mean, they called his number all the time in the third and fourth quarter. Mm-hmm. I mean, they held the ball for what, almost 10 minutes in that third quarter. I mean, both teams got one possession in the third quarter. That's what you call taking the air out of the ball. So I'm excited about the team. I think the coach has got them heading in the right direction. I think they're showing a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of grit. Now we've just got to start closing on those ones.
Absolutely.
I mean, if they had won either one of those last two games, the conversation would be different. Yeah. But the fact that anybody's calling that, oh, there needs to be a change, they're crazy. Yeah. It just doesn't make any sense. And we've spent a lot of times in our lives watching Arizona football, and we know the highs and lows. Yeah. We are not anywhere close to needing to make a dramatic change. That it's not even close.
Yeah, I think that'd be stupid. And they put a new offensive and defensive coordinator. Like, they put new coordinators, leaders for offense and defense in this year, and I think that the change has been good.
Oh, right? I think absolutely.
The change has been apparent. The improvement is apparent. Maybe that's the right choice of words. The improvement has been apparent to anybody watching. So, yeah.
No, absolutely. Well, we've got a great show today. Later this morning, we're going to have Jaime Malera with us from one of the founders and partners at Malera Alvarez, and we're going to catch up on some political information. I've got some good polling from Noble Predictive Insights that I'm going to present. We'll hit that at the bottom of the hour. And then at the 8 o'clock hour, we're going to be joined by Colleen Sanchez, the vice president out at IBM, a major employer in this region, a major impact in this region. It will be great to talk, and we're going to talk with her about artificial intelligence. Some people might say there's not a lot of intelligence on this show, but if we're going to have to create artificial intelligence,
we'll
do it.
Some might say any of mine is artificial, but, you know, it's okay. I'll wear that. It's all right. Yeah, looking forward to that, man. Looking forward to that.
But before we get there, we've kind of heard a drumbeat recently, a lot of focus on public safety, I mean, sure. There's been groups like Tucson Crime Free Coalition and others, but I was really surprised Sunday to find two articles, not one, but two articles in the Arizona Daily Star. One was titled "The Crackdown on Crimes Related to Homelessness." It was done by Erica Wurst and Charles Borla, yep, who've been doing a lot of digging. And they go through and they talk real heavily. An interesting point of the current crackdowns and the current things that have been going on. They started their interview with a young gentleman named Roy Trout, who says he's feeling the heavy weight of the target on his back. And he told them he's been on the Tucson streets for more than three decades.
Amazing.
So we always talk about, are there any people that just want to live that way? He may be one. And I found that kind of ironic as they went through and got his input on all the folks that are being kicked out of the camps, you know, the police crackdown they had over by the Loop and in the Washes, which, remember, camping in Washes is illegal in Tucson. They've changed that law. So there were several, I believe, two or three police actions taken to try to clear out some of these areas, to try to make it safer for folks using the Loop and to try to enforce some of the actual laws that are on. And it was interesting because they got a pretty big response of people that are going, okay, the hammer and the scalpel, well, this is a good thing. And they framed it that way. And there's folks out there that are really strong, and it's ironic to hear some of the comments about it being strong coming from folks like Sam Credio, the director of the Department of Mobility and Transportation,
sure,
who outlined in this article that basically comes out and throws some of the numbers down on the public safety in the transit area, right, that open air drug use is probably the number one challenge they're experiencing right now. We've talked about that for a long time on this show and in other fronts. But the thing that caught my eye about Sam's comment was through the first five months of the year, there have been 15,394 incidents. And 80% of those occurred at bus stops or on buses. And then the remaining 20% occurred in the transit centers, the three transit centers. But think about that. 5 months. 5 months is about 150 days. Mm-hmm. 15,000 incidents.
Mm-hmm.
That means there's over 100 incidents a day.
Correct.
Related to our transit system. And we're just now having this conversation.
Right. And so a couple of dynamics and, you know, broken record here, but, you know, all of a sudden it's an issue because we're in the middle of an election. People are voting now. A bicyclist was fatally stabbed in an altercation, just out using on a recreational, the Huckleberry Loop, a recreational trail through town, Huckleberry Loop, recreational trail. He's out there. Oh, what do we always say? Oh, get out there, get healthy, get on your bike. You know, he's out there with his buddies taking a ride. Okay. He gets fatally stabbed. So, you know, I can sit here and pontificate, well, you know, the motivation of dealing with all this was because of election being out there. And there's probably some truth to that. Also, finally, I guess the business community didn't matter to the mayor, right? But, you know, the cycling community, that is a very vocal and engaged community who, I guess, that was enough. That was enough to get the city engaged to at least increase their efforts, you know, doing a raid on the loop there by a bunch of retail over by Stone and First and the river.
And enforcing our laws.
Yeah, enforcing laws. So, you know, business people coming, you know, she talks about, hey, people come, the mayor says, oh, you know, people have been taking a back seat. We need everybody to come to the table. They've been coming to the table for years. And what has she said? Oh, you don't, what you see is not really what you see. It's not that bad. It's, oh, if you look at crime, compared to during COVID, it's not so bad. Well, yeah, during COVID was an extraordinary experience. I didn't even realize until Conover said that they had a huge murder spike, homicide spike,
right,
during COVID. But my point is, well, if you say, well, it's down compared to this anomaly, you know, well, that's an easy statistic to lasso and say, oh, look, crime's down. You ask people that do business, people who engage with the Southern Arizona Leadership Council, people that engage with any business group around town, they'll talk about all the money they have to spend hardening their location, you know, people whacked out of their minds. And I'm sorry for the human misery. This guy that they interviewed at the beginning, I get it. And I feel for him. But the reporter didn't ask him, how have you been supporting yourself? Have you been part of theft? Have you been part of defacing things when you're high? You know, have you been part of stripping copper wire? I'm not saying this man has, but, you know, there are two sides to the story.
And my point on using him as the focal point of thing, he's been living on the streets for 30 years. I truly believe he may be one of those ones that we talk about that aren't causing harm, aren't doing things. So, of course, this is impinging on him, but that's not the problem.
And yeah, he is one, as you say, he's one
exception.
Person. Yeah. And so articles do this all the time. They'll find the story that, you know, whatever tugs at your heartstrings. And trust me, you and I are on the same page that the human misery is awful, and I don't celebrate it. I don't somehow, you know, minimalize it. That is no way to live. It is no way to live like that.
And I'll give both Erica and Charles Borla, Erica Wurst and Charles Borla, credit. It was a good report that had a lot of the things that are occurring that are problematic with what we're facing. And it's ironic because at the end, it quoted Mayor Romero and she said, so this is a call to action. What got my attention was the other article that was in the Daily Star.
Yep.
And that was Tim Steller.
Sure.
And Tim's been calling things out on the city for a while. And he started his article with, is Tucson going to give Romero even a stronger hand? And it pointed out the fact that the three Democrats that are in the county, has already won her, Selena Barajas has already won her candidate, and you've got Miranda Schubert. And then when you combine in District 1, and then you've got Kevin Dahl, who's a current sitting member on, Ward 1, and then Ward 6, and then Ward 3's mm-hmm. Kevin Dahl. Mm-hmm. But when you take Schubert, Barajas, and we don't know as much about Barajas, we know that you know, Miranda Schubert's very, very much aligned with the mayor, maybe even a little bit more left than the mayor. And we know Lane Santa Cruz is lined up on
total progressive.
A lot of the same actions.
Mm-hmm. Schubert.
All of a sudden, there's going to be four votes. Mm-hmm. That will leave Kevin Dahl, Nikki Lee, and And the article talks about replacing moderate Democrats, because Steve Kasachek, you know, a Republican turned moderate Democrat. Richard Fibris, considered a moderate Democrat. Well, things are changing. But the thing I found ironic about Steller's approach is he went through it and he said he's listening to everything that they're saying that they need to do, that the Safe City initiatives. Mm-hmm. He'd read part of it and go, great. And then he'd see something else. He doesn't see any change. It's what they've been trying to do for the last...
This has been their plan of action for the last several years.
Mm-hmm. And so far, it hasn't worked. Mm-hmm. He does call some things out, and because Nikki Lee came out and got pretty last Thursday in her... newsletter. She put out some things saying very clearly she thinks we need to raise, we need to put fares back in the buses. That's it. Fares, or, you know, Paul Cunningham suggested using transit cards so that at least they knew who was on the buses and they can track bad performance.
Been called for years these microphones.
All of this stuff was on
there. A lot of people.
But it was really interesting to see Tim Steller say, this is more of the same. And it appears we're going to have more of the same at the ballot.
He just can't come out and say, maybe it's change. Vote for these other two just for some just for some diversity of thought on the council. Well, he can't cross that bridge to say it.
And you know how dangerous it could be if somebody endorses a Republican in the city of Tucson. So it's a challenge. We are going to go to a break now. When we come back, we'll be joined with Jaime Malera, and we will discuss some of the upcoming things to look forward in the next several months politically and what's going on in the state of Arizona. Stay with us. We're 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm Ted Maxwell, your host, Matt Neely, behind the glass. Thank you for that conversation, Matt. We, as always, once we get started, we go on a roll. I'm proud to be joined by one of our few repeat guests, Jaime Malera, the founder and it's a founder and partner for Malera Alvarez, a firm that we work with very closely up in the Phoenix area and throughout the state. Jaime, good morning. Appreciate you taking the time to join us today.
Good morning, Ted. How are you doing?
Doing well. So I know I was honored the last time the governor took a trip to Mexico City to go down with her, and I remember you were there, but it sounds like you're still in Phoenix this time, and your partner, Ruben Alvarez, is taking the governor's trip to Mexico City.
That's right. I'm here doing the people's work, Ted, while he's out gallivanting.
There it is, the people's work. I love it. So knowing what you know about that trip, what are the expectations on this one? It's kind of a unique situation with everything else going on with the relationship with Mexico, Canada, the USMCA, and all that. What is the governor trying to accomplish down in Mexico City?
Well, I would think that she's certainly wanting to press upon why getting the USMCA redo, which is, you know, that's coming up for recertification this next year, on why it's important to have leaders talk about getting that redone and making sure that we get a new agreement that really fits the needs of Arizona. So when we did USMCA originally, gosh, about 10 years ago already, Arizona didn't have the kinds of, like, TSMC that's been coming in, right? A lot of these high-level chip manufacturers, and that's recently exploded. So those are the kinds of things, looking at particular industries, that I think would be helpful for Arizona to try and position ourselves for and work with the Mexican officials on trying to see if there's an accord on the kinds of things that we need to do to be successful.
And obviously, the reauthorization of the USMCA, whether it's through bilateral or tri-nation agreements, is going to be an important thing. But what's the role that Arizona can play directly as far as trade with Mexico?
Well, as you know, we're dealing with some fairly significant issues. The produce industry, for instance, there was some restrictions that were put on tomatoes. And that's been very damaging in a lot of ways to our southern Arizona economy, particularly along the border. You know, I'm born and raised in Nogales, and that's I know a lot of folks down there that have really been struggling with that. So I think the governor trying to put more of a spotlight on those kinds of issues, hopefully that leads to ways we can rectify those kinds of issues that have been hurting us.
So Jaime, your organization's been really involved in getting this conversation. You mentioned the USMCA's up for renewal. The session has just opened on input and there's still some concern if that's going to be trilateral, bilateral, how that's going to work. It sounds like the administration wants to go down bilateral. But as part of that, you put on three forums that gave two in Phoenix, and you came down to Tucson to do one that gave folks and speakers the opportunity to talk about the importance of the input. What were some of the key items you gleaned from those three forums?
Well, those forums turned out to be fantastic because we had tremendous participation from industries, some of the industries I had mentioned earlier. So the fresh produce industry, certainly the chip manufacturers, high-level manufacturing organizations took part. And it's really just to talk about some of the things that we need to do, start working together. I know Arizona, one of our partners in this discussion was the Arizona District Export Council. And they're pretty much taking the lead on preparing the public comment and the submission in support of the USMCA renewal. And I think some of the information that was gleaned from these forums helped the woman that's leading that up. Her name is Carol Colombo, and that organization and their efforts to frame what would be arguments on what should be done as part of this renewal. So that was a very successful forums, I think, because it really gave us good information on how to proceed.
And I know there's a lot of entities that are trying to get behind it now and try to come up with what's best. We're going to continue to turn to folks like yourself who have been working on it and Carol Colombo and some of the bigger entities. When we come back, I mean, I'd like to shift a little bit more to the Arizona political climate and maybe talk about some of the races and what you anticipate for the next legislative session, if that sounds good to you. All right. Well, I appreciate you being here as always. We're going to go to the bottom of the hour. Great job on a short segment. Stay with us. We'll be back on 10:30 The Voice, your trusted local news and talk station. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. It is Tuesday, October 21st. So thank you for joining us today. Jaime Malera is with us. Jaime, again, thank you for joining me this morning. I always appreciate it. I know I can count on you when I reach out. So thank you for being with us.
Happy to be here.
So I've shared with you some information that I got from Mike Noble with Noble Predictive Insights. It was some polling data that was put together in August. And it kind of surprised me on how Arizonans sit right now about how they feel about if Arizona, and the question was, is Arizona going on the right track or is Arizona going in the wrong direction? You know, for a long time, it had been going in the wrong direction from COVID to through the beginning of the Hobbs administration. As we got in the later part of 2004, it started to narrow, and it looked like when the Trump second administration was going to go, it was going to cross, but it actually hasn't. It's still sitting at about a 51% believe Arizona's going in the wrong direction, 49% think it's going in the right direction. What do you think's driving those type of numbers?
Well, I think it's just reflective of our political environment right now. You know, half of the country likes who's in charge and half of the country hates who's in charge. So it just seems like that tends to split down the middle on all kinds of things. And the people that believe Trump is doing a good job, they'll say, yeah, I think we're going in the right direction, and vice versa. So I think it's just a mirroring of what we've seen nationally.
And I think what I found most interesting in a large part was that, one, I agree totally with you, and it's staying right at that 50-50 point. But when we went back to the most important issues that are facing Arizonans, over the last several years, there hasn't been a ton of changes. Immigration, inflation, affordable housing, and healthcare are easily the four that are in the top three. What's your thought, one, on those four categories or why they rank so high? And how does that line up with what you see potential in the next year's legislative session?
Well, from a political standpoint, I believe if Arizonans are concerned about education and healthcare, that tends to favor what the governor's trying to do and some of the initiatives that the Democrats want to see happen. And from a political standpoint, that's a good thing for them. I think when those issues are at the forefront of a lot of Arizonans' minds, they tend to believe the Democrats have a more aptitude to deal with those areas. But when you're talking about concerns over immigration and concerns over law enforcement issues, that really does tend to favor the Republicans. And so immigration continues to be a very hot button issue for the residents of this state. And that tends to bode well for what the Republicans propose in the legislature, as well as, you know, the political standing. Because, again, on that front, I think people tend to think Republicans have a better policies that deal with those, especially immigration and law enforcement issues.
So next year is going to, obviously, 26 is a midterm election cycle on the national front, but it's always, the even years are always one for the legislature going into. How is that going to impact the ability next year for the legislature to get things done?
Well, I know you're shocked that politics comes into play when we're talking about legislative policies, but that's what's going to happen. You're going to see the governor try and position herself in a way that supports her reelection bid. And certainly the Republicans are going to do everything they can to not give her any wins. I think they're going to have some problems just starting off, because the budget situation is not too good right now. I think the Joint Legislative Budget Committee has talked about having anywhere between $500 million to $750 million deficit. And so there's going to be some very tough decisions that they're going to have to make regardless of the politics. But then when you add the politics into the mix, it makes things fairly tough to get things done. Things like Prop 123 that I know you've talked about quite a bit, and we've talked about whether or not that extension of that state trust lands eventually gets done, and it takes that pressure off the state budget that funds that education amount.
And that's a great point that you bring up. The legislature wasn't able to put it back to the voters, so therefore, by legal ruling and law, they were required to cover that funding, and that's a significant amount of the budget. Do you think there's any chance they'll get to a compromise on what to send to the voters for 1, 2, 3?
Well, the reason last year it stalled is that the Republicans had wanted to see, they were saying, okay, let's go ahead and renew this. Oh, by the way, but we also want protections on ESAs, which is the Education Scholarship Accounts vouchers that Arizona has implemented the last couple of years. And of course, the governor's office and her supporters, particularly the Arizona Education Association, the teachers unions, were adamantly against that. So you had a stalemate. Interesting to see if there's any give, if the Republicans are able to get some assurances that there's not going to be rollbacks of that particular effort, then you might have some ability to get a deal done. But barring that, I think it's going to be a stalemate once again.
Jaime, it was really interesting to me right there when you're saying all those things. It sounds an awful lot like what the federal government's facing. We've got a governmental shutdown for laws that have already been passed, and in this case, the Democrats want to renegotiate it. And I think with 1, 2, 3, it's a little bit of the other way around, but it's the same thing. They want to include other negotiations in solving a problem. Federal budget, for us, it's 1, 2, 3.
Right. Yeah, right. That's exactly right.
That's just hard to believe. I do want to point out one slide because I want to get your opinion on it. Mm-hmm. Arizona mail-in voting's always been a big deal, and now the president's come out and said he's going to try to limit mail-in voting and do that. Mm-hmm. Yet one of the things in Noble Predictive Insights poll was on the preferred status of mail-in voting, and not shockingly, 75% of Arizonans want to either keep it the same or make it easier to vote by mail.
Well, that doesn't surprise me. That Arizona has been fairly effective, in my opinion, in implementing vote by mail. I think people in all walks of life have come to see the ease of doing it, particularly when, as you know, Ted, when you get your ballots and they're 4 or 5 pages nowadays, and there's so many different things that are on the ballots. It's so much easier to really think through it at your house and talk it through with maybe your wife or your husband and be able to vote in a way that's, you know, not crazy, rather than going down to the voting lines and waiting for several hours. So I think people love the convenience of it, and it doesn't surprise me that Arizonans want to keep it.
And I think the last time the Republican Party also recognized that the mail-in voting is what the majority of people do. Matter of fact, the poll showed that 68% of Republicans felt either keep it the same way or make it easier. The Democrats were much higher. They were in about 91%. Then the independents were over 70. I think what scares me the most, you mentioned the five-page ballot, is the folks who walk into the voting booth, and that's the first time they're looking at the ballot.
Right.
I mean, they may know who they want to vote for governor, for president, or for Senate, or their congressman. Everything else then becomes a guessing game, and they tend to then just fall straight on, you know, party lines, whatever the letters they recognize, instead of actually being an informed voter. And to me, you've got to be an informed voter.
I couldn't agree more, but it really does happen that way. I think you have at the top of the ticket the big races. In this case, in 26, you're going to have the governor's race, the attorney general's race. But then as you get down ticket, you're right. People tend to fall back into their, whether or not they're an R or a D next to that name, and that tends to be the driver. And that's why Republicans, I think, in a lot of ways, stand to have a better year. You know, midterm elections tend to go against the presidential party that's in power. And all historical data says that midterms probably is a time for the Democrats to gain a lot of ground. Well, in Arizona, the problem that Democrats have is that they've been dropping in registrations considerably. The GOP now has a 330,000 voter advantage, and that's a big deal to overcome. So they're going to need a lot of Republicans to either stay home or try and get those capture all those independent voters, and that's a pretty tough thing to do.
Yeah, I think there people have been very surprised by those swings in the party thing. So you brought it up, so let's talk about it. The governor's race. So far, Governor Hobbs has been able to keep her side of the ticket clean. Looks like she's probably going to not have a primary. But for a long time, it's been a battle between the two Trump endorsees, Karen Taylor Robeson and Andy Biggs. Well, now Congressman David Schweikert's also said he's throwing his hat in the ring. We've got about little over two more minutes. I mean, I want to hear your insight. What do you think, and how does his entrance into this race affect things?
Well, I think it has an effect, but I'm not so sure it will really have the ability to sway who I think is going to be tough to beat, and that's Andy Biggs. The reason I think Andy Biggs is tough is that he has the endorsement. Both he and Karen Taylor Robeson have the endorsement of President Trump, as we all know. But the difference is that Andy Biggs has the endorsement of Turning Point, as well as Club for Growth. Now, both of those organizations, especially Turning Point, as we've seen what happened with the Charlie Kirk assassination, there's a lot of outpouring of support by Republicans for that organization. And if they're behind Biggs, that makes a big deal. And so between that and the money that's coming in that those organizations also have, I think that'll nullify a lot of the advantage that Karen Taylor Robeson had, because she was very wealthy and able to self-fund. Schweikert comes from the same type of Republican Party, like the more fiscal conservative that I think Robeson has been courting. He's never been a big people from Turning Point have never been big supporters of Schweikert. So that's why I don't see that really having an impact on Biggs.
Well, it's going to be interesting when we see the first sets of polling. I'm not sure your confidence level in polling, but we'll see if David polls from either side. I know David Schweikert's done a good job of reaching out to the conservative community down here in this region, so I know he's got a lot of supporters.
And then the other wild card is the lieutenant governor. This is the first time that they're going to have running mates. So it'll be interesting to see how both utilize that new tool that they have.
So in a one-word answer, will they name lieutenant governor candidates before the end of the primary?
I think, for instance, like Karen Taylor Robeson is going to have to. I think she's going to want a big name that maybe can appeal to those Turning Point members. And so, whereas I think Andy Biggs might get somebody that's more maybe in the old McCain wing of the party. Who knows?
Absolutely. It's going to be interesting. A new role, a new change. So that's Jaime Molero with Molero Alvarez. Thank you for joining us, Jaime. I greatly appreciate it. It's always you're always very insightful, and we'll hope to have you back on soon again.
You bet. Thank you very much, Ted.
All right. Stay with us. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. So, question for you today. Do you have an estate plan that protects you while you're alive and when you play? And think about this. If you were in a accident or had a sudden illness and couldn't speak for yourself, who would make decisions for your medical care or your money? With a plan, your family could end up in court fighting over your future. That's why we're joined today by Chris Cohen from JP Estate Planning, helping heirs protect their families for over 35 years. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Ted.
Doing well today. Let's start with what if someone is alive, but they can make their decisions.
Yeah, Ted. So this is something that most people don't think about. You know, will only works after you die. While you're alive, you can't make decisions. The court may step in to appoint someone to make your decisions for you. Last year, Arizona had over 121,000 car accidents reported. More than 1,200 of those were fatal. Imagine you see an accident but can't speak or make decisions. Doctors follow Arizona's priority list to decide who would make decisions if you can't. First, your spouse, then your adult child, than your parents. But what if your family disagrees? To appoint a neutral stranger for long-term care decisions.
Not just for medical care, correct? If your finances can get tied up in this as well.
Exactly. Without a living trust, your family may not be able to manage your money. They might have to go to court, which can cost time and money. Financial power of attorney can help, letting someone you trust your bills, access your bank, and handle your finances. Then with a financial power of attorney, some assets may still need approval. That's why most estate planners recommend both in trust to protect your assets and avoid court, and a financial power of attorney to handle day-to-day finances while you're alive.
Important to know, how can people stay in control while they're alive?
So by creating a complete estate plan, like at RDP Estate Planning, we help you set up a living trust. Protect your assets and finances if you become incapacitated, and keep your estate out of probate court after you pass away, and your assets pass smoothly to your loved ones, and a medical power of attorney to pick who makes your medical decisions if you can't. Also, a financial power of attorney, someone handle your bills and finances right away. Healthcare direct and a living will tell your family what kind of medical care you want. With these documents, your family can act right away. Your wish followed, and the court doesn't get involved.
Those documents, they seem very powerful if you find yourself in that situation. And you mentioned probate, area that can catch families off guard.
Yes, so I'm going to avoid probate. It guarantees it. That means that public court liens and potentially long delay your family and hefty legal fees settle your estate. So a living trust lets your assets transfer freely and quickly, saving time, money, and stress.
So a properly done estate plan for you're alive and when you pass away.
Exactly. Without one, bills could go unpaid, property can fall closure, and families can spend money. With an estate plan, families can act immediately there for you and handle your finances while you're still alive. And when you pass away, your debts bypass probate and are passed on to your family.
And RJP does more than just documents. You provide both the tools and the support as well.
Yes. Every client gets a power of attorney ID cards for their wallet, so first responders know who to contact. At RJP Estate Planning, we also provide a secure USB drive with all of your documents, quick access. Through our guiding heart engine, we help families find assisted living, memory care, or independent living. We arrange tours, handle paper, and guide families through the process. And after you pass away, RJP provides free settlement support for your loved ones. We walk them through every step on how to see your estate and receive their inheritance.
That's amazing support. Listeners, a properly done estate planning protects you when you're alive and when you pass away. If you don't have one or you're outdated, now's the time to make everything in your estate plan is up. Call RJP Estate Planning at 520-441-5200. 23 to schedule your free strap meeting. Right now, if you're over 55, you can save 55% on a trust package, but only if you call by this Thursday. Again, that's 520-441-4523. Don't leave your family unprotected today and let RJP Planning help you plan for your life's whens and protect against life's what if. Call 520-441-4523. As always, we appreciate your insight. Thanks for sharing these critical details about why we all need a proper estate.
Thanks, Ted. I appreciate your time.
You have a good day, and we'll talk to you soon.
Look to it. Bye now.
All right. Take care.
Please stay with us on The Morning Voice. We'll be back with Colleen Sanchez from IBM. You're listening to 1030 The Voice.
Big Blue right here. Big Blue.
Big Blue is in the studio. So we've got Big Blue here. So stay with us on 1030 The Voice, your trusted local news and talk station. Good morning and welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell, Matt Neely behind the glass. The Morning Voice, 5 days a week, five different hosts, five different topics. Here we focus on getting people engaged and involved in the community. And my next guest is incredibly involved in the community. Matter of fact, she was recognized as the 2024 Woman of the Year by Greater Tucson Leadership. And I really appreciate having Colleen Sanchez with us today. Thank you, Colleen, for joining me.
Oh, thank you very much for having me, Ted. And by the way, I think you received Man of the Year same year I did. So
that may have happened, something like that. Colleen is the Vice President for IBM Technology and Lifecycle Services Competitive Strategy. Now that's a mouthful.
Yes.
But what we always like to do, the purpose of this show is to talk with people about how they can get engaged and where they came from and how the backgrounds of some of the folks that we now see out in the community that are community leaders like yourself. So can you kind of give the listeners a background of where you grew up and what led you to IBM eventually?
Yeah, sure. So I was born in Las Cruces, New Mexico. The majority of my family was educated. A number of PhDs working at Sandia National Laboratories as well as Los Alamos. So much of my my time as a child was more, okay, what PhD are you going to work on? And my father...
No pressure.
No, I know.
No pressure.
My father reminds me I still don't have one. So,
yeah. Are you going to say such a disappointment?
Oh, I know. Huge. Yeah. And I'm sure he thinks that in his head. So... as far as what led me to IBM, I guess I'll just say my experience with growing up with my father and family. I'm the oldest of seven. My father worked on his basically bachelor's, master's in New Mexico. He was an Aggie, or still is an Aggie. Then we moved to Ames, Iowa, and he went to Iowa State. So the great thing about my experience as a child is open to ideas and debate, and the fact that in theory, you may have an idea and you should have a discussion about it. And so being so close to the universities helped ground me, build that foundation for what I have experienced within IBM. Eventually, he became an associate professor for the University of Florida. He wanted to work in wetlands so what he does is he's a fertility scientist, so soil and water. And so he focused quite a bit on both with regards to soil and water, because he's looking he reminded me when I joined IBM, you may want to build a smarter planet. I want to feed the planet.
And is that what brought you to Yuma?
Yes. So living in Florida, of course, knowing it was a bit after of the in 1986, the Challenger mission disaster, and being myself as a child disappointed that that occurred and wanting to understand why, I started to basically cut out news clipping articles, etc., reading about what occurred and why, and later found out that IBM Tucson partnered with NASA to recover fragments of tape media off the bottom of the ocean. And first of all, I had asked my dad, hey, what is the acronym IBM? And so he let me know, but he didn't think anything. Then I asked him later on, where is Tucson, Arizona on the map? Like, I know where Arizona is. And then he was like, why are you asking me about Tucson? And I was like, well, I'm just curious. It was the articles that I was reading, right? And he said, well, did you go through my briefcase? And then that's when I started to realize or connected later on that he was applying for a position at the University of Arizona and that he would eventually be the director of farms in Yuma. And that's when we moved to Yuma. His story was, we wanted to get closer to your grandparents who lived in New Mexico. So it's like Yuma, so close to New Mexico.
It's the other side of the state, but it's it's a state next door.
True.
Yeah, so you graduated from high school in Yuma, and then you attended?
So I attended the University of Arizona.
Bear
so
down.
I'm definitely a proud Wildcat. Three degrees from there. So IBM at that time had interest in me to graduate, just flash forward with at that point in time. So they promised me that they would support me for my second bachelor's and then eventually my master's.
And you actually started with IBM as an intern, is that
yes,
correct?
Yes, so a co-op. Okay. So basically I would work full-time with them. So when it was the internship phase, I was an intern at Sandia National Labs. So I started to be a national lab intern. I was about 16 once the government actually approved my government clearance.
Well, so that's a connection with your dad.
Yeah.
That's pretty incredible.
My grandfather at that time worked at Sandia. He was a mechanical engineer. So
did you ever imagine when you started with IBM? I think you first was a full-time employee in 2001. You were an intern in 19 yeah. and early full employee yeah. 2001. Did you ever imagine you'd be where you are today?
Possibly, because I started to get very excited about IBM and its innovations. So just to take a step back, why IBM and why so many years? So I just celebrated a quarter century. So the fact that I'm 25 years with IBM, I'm so excited. It actually still gives me chills. It's a great big candy store. And with regards to innovations and working with tremendously smart people, and the thing I have to remind myself every day, maybe it's a post-it on my mirror or something, is like, don't eat too much candy. And I do that quite a bit. That's the reason why I have, you know, a certain kind of beverage in front of me.
I won't tell them what's a big, looks like a big beer can, but it's not beer. It's just the opposite. So I think when I drink the caffeinated coffee here, I get a little wired. So we can both be wired together on the next 45 minutes. It'll be good. So you started then with IBM.
Mm-hmm.
Has your career always been in Tucson?
No, for a period of time, I did move to New York. At that point in time, I was married to my husband, Chad Dreger, who's the president of Southern Arizona Northern Trust. And so, by the way, he was also born in Yuma. So from that perspective, I had to negotiate with him that I would spend a little bit over a year in Armonk, New York, IBM corporate headquarters, working for the then executive vice president of innovation, head of research.
And during that time, was AI even on your vision?
Yes. We were actually already working on data analytics, deep insights, as well as machine learning in early days of AI. So if you go back to some of the history of the internet also is like what IBM did to partner with Yahoo or Google, or why I started with IBM was Markov chain statistics. So it all relates. And by the way, Google's a wonderfully smart search engine because of Markov chain. So from that perspective, it all ties together because the root of it, data. Data drives the insights we look to gather. And so, in other words, by experience, not necessarily by degree, you learn to be a data scientist and thinking about how you can pull repositories of data together. And so think as a human, how much data would that we've collected over multiple hundreds of years now. Well, now we actually have the smarts to discern insights to better our lives.
Well, I think that's a great setup. So I'm going to go ahead and take our first break here a little early. That way we'll have a longer next session. But before we go, I think you need to let the listeners know. So what does IBM stand for?
Okay.
But before we go.
International Business Machines.
There you go. So it's business machines. It's good. Yes. Yeah, a lot of people, everybody knows Big Blue being IBM. Not everybody knows the name for the company and its origins. So that's the voice of Colleen Sanchez, the vice president for a lot of things going on out at the UA Tech Part and the IBM facility out there. Stay with us. We'll be back on 10:30 The Voice, your trusted local news and talk, and talk more about artificial intelligence. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm Ted Maxwell, your host. Matt Neely is behind the glass, keeping us on time, on target, as well as picking the music. Tomorrow, make sure to tune in to The Morning Voice with Grant Kruger. During the first hour, he's going to have Laura Iacobucci to promote Tucson Action Team's Doggy Dance Party at St. Phillips Plaza on Thursday.
Iacobucci the Booch, all right, okay.
Yep. Coming in for that. And he's still waiting confirmation on his guest for the second hour, but being the inevitable promoter, he wanted to make sure everybody was aware that this evening at St. Phillips Plaza, he will be holding a Take Back Pima Turning Point event at 6 p.m. And as I said, 5 days, five different hosts. Some of us, you get a little bit more political. Well, some of us would be me and Grant predominantly, but Grant will be hosting that event tonight. So if you've got, if you're looking for something to do tonight at 6 o'clock, go to St. Phillips Plaza. I'm sure it'll be an interesting conversation. And then tune in tomorrow morning. If you can't make it tonight, I'm sure Grant will talk about it tomorrow. So make sure you turn in and listen to his show tomorrow as well. So Colleen Sanchez is my guest today with IBM. We've learned a lot about your life, your growing up. One of the things that we didn't cover is the number of numerous organizations you work for, both on the leadership front, but also on the charity front. You're an angel charity. You've worked on with the United Way. So I just want to say thank you for all you do in this community. It's important, your role at IBM, and that's why I think we're excited, Big Blue being in the studio. But also what you do in the community makes a difference.
Well, thank you very much. I would say as an individual, this is Colleen's opinion, you have to love where you live and work.
And therefore, you have to get engaged. Yes. We talk about that all the time. Find something you're passionate about and get involved.
Yes.
It can be a nonprofit. It can be political advocacy. It can be just getting out the vote. Do something that you support your community. So I appreciate you throwing those words out there too. So now let's talk about artificial intelligence. I think it's probably that you teased us in the first segment by saying it's really just data, but can you kind of just set up what it is about artificial intelligence right now and what people should know?
Okay. So I would first say that, so a prior CEO, Jenny Rometty, I respected her immensely in that, you know, we could have done better from a business perspective. I'll put that out there because there's most likely a lot of financial folks in the audience that think, oh, IBM could have done better. Though she had a very thoughtful mindset and she was an engineer. She said to us when she was there at IBM that data was the new oil. And the other thing in big concept, she said, AI is augmented intelligence for humankind. So what it told us as engineers and scientists working on the business side as well as in research is that we wanted to live another 100 years. We're 113 years old. We basically want to make sure that we are building out innovations in analytics around data and would grow from there to become AI, though never losing the human part of the machine or what we were building, because we were looking to emulate human behavior.
So you're not thinking we're going to face a robot takeover anytime soon?
No, okay. I'm not personally. What's great about this time is like this is a time to pivot and remind yourselves how to be more human, how to embrace your emotions, how to think more thoughtfully about other people and people's feelings. And I was actually even this morning on a call talking about removing bias from AI algorithms and how we can enable a more fair approach. Biases come in many different forms. Sometimes they're thoughtful biases. So I thought that was interesting that it's all about becoming and knowing how more human we all can be.
Well, that brings up an interesting point, and some folks understand, and we, without getting into too much of the technical detail, is AI really is a learning system. And Correct. So if it's learning, the user mm-hmm. can train it in any way they want to work for their advantage.
Correct, especially based on the questions that you ask it. So think about it. Data is the oil that feeds the actual AI tool. Let's just say that AI could be a portal or a tool. You think of like ChatGPT or a Gemini, there's a portal in which you ask it a question. And that question will be a certain set of statements or facts. Now, what's interesting about that is it's learning. So think about like a bit ago when you ask something 20 questions and hopefully you're about to find out whatever answer. So just to be clear on what AI is it's a whole bunch of data pulled together for greater insights. And the traditional computing and the chipsets we have can look at words and associate words and come to understanding a lot more quickly than our own brain, which, by the way, our human brain is the first processor.
Well, that is true. Sometimes that's scary. Some people have, you know, modern chips, and some of us have the older chips still that are sitting around. So on the learning front, you mentioned some of the ones that are out there, Gemini and some mm-hmm. of the others. I know IBM's got some
yeah.
AI systems out there too. For most of us, should we be trusting the results those give us? Like if we put something in any of them?
So you should, it's a great question. I would say that we're in the infant and if not toddler phase of AI at this point, it's probably infancy mostly, where it's like this repository of data is not always cleansed. It's not clean. So it may not be giving you the right answer.
And that I think right now people are using, I know the University of Arizona has made a big issue about they are starting to incorporate AI into their learning, into yeah. their processes. So you're basically saying it's an infant, it's a baby.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't we wait till it becomes the adult to use it? Or will it not become an adult if we don't use it?
Exactly. You just hit the nail on the head where you have to use it or ask it questions so it grows. Think about like us as humans, like growing up, we have to ingest and understand data, create or experience new things in order for us to learn to be much more a holistic being.
And so on that front let's break it down. There's businesses, there's mm-hmm. education, and then there's just us dealing with society on the common day activities.
Yeah.
Where do you think AI is going to have the biggest impact?
So I think initially, and this is Colleen's opinion, is there's going to be a great amount of insights around healthcare and how we can treat and heal diseases more quickly based on the data that we've collected of humans for quite some time. I think healthcare is a key component. Also, when I think about it, taking a step back, IBM's portfolio is what we call Watson X. So Watson actually, its core focus is NLP. What is NLP? Natural language processing. So if you remember a few years ago when IBM had a computer, Watson, play on Jeopardy.
Played on Jeopardy. And did Watson also play a little chess?
Yes, correct.
Yeah.
And that was Big Blue, some of the early days of AI
right.
that you asked prior about. Well, so we've been ingesting data for quite some time and trying to get an understanding of what that means. and how to behave more as a human and actually even exceed in some cases.
So this is where I get confused. I was an operations research major, so learned to program in Fortran back in the day and do that. So part of me says the computers only know what we tell it and what we write in code. Mm-hmm. But AI is actually letting us go beyond what we write in code. How does that interact? And when later in the show, we'll talk about the protections and the capability, but how does that occur? And who?
Well,
it started at IBM in a lot of ways, it sounds like, with the earlier AI.
Yeah, so, and I have to give credit to a lot of different companies that come up with an amazing set of innovations. So the traditional compute, you have the chipset, it receives instructions, that code that you refer to. And now with advancements based on computers, smartphones, things like that, those chips can run faster and faster. And so you're able to ingest data more quickly. So in other words, think about it. It's like instead of me, Colleen, a human brain, reading and assuming data, now these multiple processors of compute can look at all this data and drive insights that we alone cannot drive specifically or create or provide for clarity immediately. I don't know if that makes sense, so to speak, but it's almost like it's gelling together multiple technologies for greater data insights.
Does it rewrite its own code?
It can.
I think that's when people start getting worried, is when it can start going faster and processing. It's not, it's the reality is it's not going back. It's with us.
Yeah, and as a practitioner, like in the IT business, I don't necessarily, like, this is my opinion as well. Basically, I ask a question. I don't know if, actually, I hate to put it this way. I'm a little paranoid about the data I receive.
Right.
So if I'm a student wanting to answer a question to add something to a paper, you should probably look at additional sources.
Maybe find additional sources, or maybe the original source.
Yeah.
Because at some point, AI could make stuff up.
And let's be straight. Original source?
Yeah, I getcha. All right, that's the voice of Colleen Sanchez with IBM. You're listening to The Morning Voice on 1030 The Voice, your trusted local news and talk. Please stay with us through the bottom of the hour. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. My guest this morning is Colleen Sanchez with IBM. It was great talking even in between it, because you're worried about getting too technical, because you obviously have the ability to dive real deep on the technicalities on this stuff.
Yeah.
But I think you did a great job of invoking people to have thoughts and questions going on. You know, I was thinking off all my written questions, and I'm now going to other questions. What are your concerns and worries, though, with AI? And it doesn't mean the fear of AI, because I think it's something we have to embrace. Mm-hmm. It's more of the ability for us to continue to progress with AI.
So I'm with you. So I think of a few different dimensions: reclaimed water, energy. And so we need these things. Actually, I'll add a third: minerals to build additional chips. So we have to be in a situation where it's like, be respectful of the environment around us, innovate, be smart about using these very delicate resources, though at the same time, figure out how we can continue to advance. So right now, those are the things that we have to think through with regards to overall aspects of energy. So personally, just to say a shout out to the University of Arizona, the fact that they are thinking broadly, strategically, bringing in new leaders to think about AI, bringing the greatest set of minds together within the University of Arizona, as well as like talking about fusion. In a recent SALC meeting, seriously, when would you ever hear someone on stage talk about fusion?
And just yesterday, I heard President Garmela reinforce that. you know, AI, they're focusing on in the healthcare field, which you opened up about how big it is,
yeah,
that they need to do it. He talked about fusion. Why wouldn't we want to pursue fusion, which would effectively give us free, unlimited energy if we can truly create it at some point? I'm not sure anything's ever free because it's going to cost a lot of money to get there. To harness that energy. But to the point is everything we're doing in our lives requires energy, water, and it's all about that data. So I do think that's something the university is doing a good job at, and they're trying to maintain the ability to keep teaching people, because the fear is if AI can do everything, why do we need to learn?
Yeah, correct. So I'm going to talk about something with regards to energy real quick, just a quote. I have a good friend at IBM, and we were exchanging back and forth about this experience. It was free therapy. I went to her. I was like, "Hey, Chris, I'm so worried about doing this discussion with Ted." Like, and so we were exchanging, and she had said something to put in perspective specific to energy. She said, "A single large AI training run is going to be 4 to 16 gigawatts by power usage of an entire state during peak demand." And all of this being done by 2030. So if, let's say, the U.S. electricity peak is 245 gigawatts, and that's one AI instance training model, think about how much we need to enable AI to be pervasive, like all these training models to run. So I just want to give a bit of a perspective that we need to come together with all the smartest minds to, whether it's universities, whether it is industry, to come up with these ideas of like how we address some of these challenges associated with enough energy to progress AI, enough reclaimed water to progress AI, what we've got to do to transition to from traditional computing to what I heard this morning or in the Wall Street Journal, quantum computing. And quantum, this is qubits, and this is just the future of computing, which will be much different than what we know today traditionally.
So what's your worry with quantum computing? Is it gonna put us at a place where we can run farther ahead than we're maybe ready to on the energy and the water fronts, or what's your fear?
Our goal, and I'll speak this from an IBM perspective, we're continuing to partner and progress with regards to quantum computing, no question, which right now is just these large chandeliers that does computing at an immense amount of pace. Though at the same time, you've got to wrap your head around, like, you are exploring dimensions of even mathematics and space that we're not used to exploring. And that's what we are always reminding ourselves, is we need to bring the sharpest minds together.
So you talked about, when we were talking about Big Blue and chess, mm-hmm. playing that, the early stages of AI. Are we just in the early stages of quantum computing? Is it a reality already, but on a limited basis, and it could expand, or where's that likely to take
us? I would say mostly a limited basis at this point. The majority of the, and it's few, it's like you can count on one hand, deployed with regards to quantum computing, is for the benefit of healthcare.
It's amazing how that healthcare word keeps coming up.
Yes. So we want to extend our lives and heal people. And so as much as people can be scared of AI, a lot of these innovations are here to augment intelligence, to help us ensure that we have better lives.
Yeah, no, that's a great point, trying to make, to ensure that we can get to some of the solutions we're trying to seek in a more rapid manner. What's the protection that's needed around things, items like AI? I've heard a lot of folks at the meeting we had out at IBM, mm-hmm. and we discussed AI, people were standing up, well, you've got to put the safeguards in place first. But the reality is AI's there. It's out. Yeah. It's running. It's not turning back. So what do you believe are the bumpers or the safeguards that we can put around this kind of technology, or do we need to? We just need to let it work itself out.
So it's almost like playing in a sandbox when you're a child. Yeah, there should be guardrails to ensure overall safety. At the same time, you want to push the envelope with regards to the innovations that could come. So you don't want to over-regulate something that needs to grow and develop and learn, using that word that you referenced, learn. So you don't want to put it in a box so much that you're not able to innovate as quickly as you could be. And that is for the basis of America's competitiveness. Like, if we over-regulate, it could be of issue. At the same time, I'm not confused. We need to ensure trust, responsibility, removing fundamental biases, and have a thoughtful set of dialogue about how to trust. We want to enable that it's trusted, and that the sources of the data are cleansed, and the accuracy based on those portals or those tools that we're using online improve.
So you bring up a great point there. One, where do we sit as the United States on leadership in AI?
So we have room to improve.
Okay. Are we lagging? Are there other countries that are getting ahead? And the reason I ask is, part of being, you've mentioned all responsible, use the word responsible, mm-hmm. responsible leadership, because the fact, if we put the guardrails in place that allow us not to innovate, not to continue to drive, somebody else in the world's going to.
Correct.
And they may not have the same responsible take we're trying to take. So are we in a position that if we can continue to drive this discussion, or are we starting to have to really watch what others are doing more than we already do?
Well, I believe that we should always be watching others as well, and we should connect on ideas others may come up with first. So we have to be recognizing, in an open competitive market, you want to ensure the many have input. You want to hear all those various voices. It's similar to, like, in the 90s when, forgive me, this is an old comedian, Dennis Miller basically had those rant CDs. And he talked about, like, you want to sit next to the person on the plane whose belly's aching. You really don't want to listen to them, but you probably should. And because it's a voice you don't want to hear. So that basically contrarian voice is going to help us continue to progress, continue to innovate, question our theories, evaluate things in something that is so fundamental, the scientific method. We're grounded in data. We're going to make things based on fact, and we're going to progress thoughtfully. And that is what's going to make us holistic with regards to AI in the future.
All right. That's the voice of Colleen Sanchez, the vice president at IBM Tucson. I'll call it for that case. I know you do way beyond Tucson, I believe New Mexico, and up. You do a lot inside the organization. So it's important for us to hear what you're thinking on this front. Stay with us. We're going to wrap up this session on artificial intelligence, and who knows where we'll go in this last segment. You don't want to miss it. We're on 1030 The Voice, your trusted local news and talk.
By request, the request I did not see coming, Ted Maxwell.
Well, it's all good, Matt, as long as we stay out of trouble with this one. We'll let it play a little bit. This goes out to Chad Danziger. Drager. Danziger was my dad's sister's maiden name. So that, yeah. Chad Drager, Colleen Sanchez's husband. This is the song that, it's his birthday today. So happy birthday, Chad.
Very good. Happy birthday, Chad.
And this is apparently the song that was first playing when they met.
Yeah, or I don't know that we met, but I saw him working out at the gym.
Oh, there's a lot we could go with there if we go all the way back to high school and talk about nicknames and other stuff, but we won't. We don't want to get anybody in trouble, particularly you.
Yeah, thank you very much. Appreciate
Absolutely.
That.
So we've got about 6 more minutes to talk, and so I want to give you an opportunity to talk about what IBM, and everybody knows that IBM's here, and it's always a conversation. There was a time when people thought we're going to lose IBM, and you're still here. You're out at the tech park, but not many of us really understand what all occurs out there. And when we were out there last week for the SLC meeting, thank you for hosting us. It was very insightful. It's not just everybody sitting around with these great big ideas, creating these new things, but you shared with us a lot of the things that you actually already do out in the world with organizations that most people, you mentioned ESPN. I mean, yeah. Today you told me you work data with UFC of all things. So what is it that your segment of IBM and Big Blue does in this community?
All right. So with regard to Tucson, so definitely a shout out to all the engineers, employees, scientists in Tucson. There's a significant of them, hundreds of them. They are engineers, scientists, architects that work on predominantly data storage. Data storage, what does that mean? Those things that actually drive a device. There are three types of media types. Sorry, I will geek out a bit, Ed. So you have basically flash media, which is in all of our smartphones, right? Then you have spinning disk, hard disk drives, HDDs referred to, and you also have tape. Tape actually resides in flight recorders for every moving vessel, like on sea or possibly in air. And there's engineers that support all those media types and build enterprise systems to drive much of our transactions and processing around the world.
And so is the one of the differences between those data storage facilities just quantity and how much they can get, or the size of the programs it runs? What, because the rest of us human beings on this planet, we worry about what we've got in our phone. When we stick our flash drive in the computer, does it work? But you're kind of on another level.
Yeah. So just think about the millions of people that live in the United States and the transactions they enable, like just to buy things on Amazon or any general basically transaction period or purchase, that has to go through, think about all the back end, the wizard behind the curtain, so to speak. Think about how that has to work. It credits your, and then eventually debits your transaction based on your bank account. Who manages that? Do you think it's just the bank that's coming up with all that tech to push those credits and debits across the wire?
So are you saying bankers aren't good tech people?
Oh, no, they can be. Okay. They can be. It's more that they need some help. And
there you go.
IBM help them with regards to solutions end to end for us to enable transactions. So think about some of these devices that we come up, or we architect here, manufacture in Jalisco, in Guadalajara. They push these systems, the enterprise systems, and forgive me, it could be like any credit card you have in your wallet. Most likely IBM is part of or a partner with them and helps them with the technology behind the scene.
Yeah, I think that's what people miss, is all the stuff we've talked about today and the vision on AI. It's all already out there. It's already working. And I appreciate you sharing what else IBM does, because I think everybody knows it as a disk place, and there's so much more going on out there.
Yeah. I really appreciated President Crow a few years ago, basically getting on stage and talking about the amount of intellectual property that was coming out of Pima County and IBM being the primary driver of that. That means those who work at IBM are coming up with ideas, patenting U.S. patent ideas on innovations, and that's pretty impressive.
Well, we've got about one more minute. What thoughts haven't you been able to say in 30 seconds or less?
In 30 seconds or less. So we didn't spend much time on this, but I think it's extremely important to talk about basic security of your data, your personal data. Think about whether or not you should accept all those cookies. Maybe you should be thoughtful. You want the data on that website, so you reject all, but you're not able to read it. Well, maybe there's a solution, like you are able to determine what things you're going to give them access to.
because your data, your personal data, you have that right.
And that's a great point, because you can always hit the other button that doesn't say accept all. You hit the other one and they let you choose, and they'll give you the minimum required to run the thing.
Correct.
You also mentioned, and we don't have time, probably not a good idea to keep Siri on all the time. Alexa's always listening, and we will have you back to talk more tech. You may become my technical expert. Thank you for staying with us today. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to The Morning Voice. Stay with us for Win Tucson, which will come up to follow.
And join us at the Eat and Greet on Thursday at The Pad on Tool Avenue, just south of Broadway.
Come play a little pickleball.
Well, yeah, sure.
And talk to us all. So thank you, Colleen. It's been a great show.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll see you next week.